Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast, and this is our first interview in a series of interviews with the authors of Lore of the Traditions, a book that is currently being kickstarted by the Onyx Path that expands and updates the traditions, or at least the lore and magic available to them in M20. If you just found out about this show through said Kickstarter, this is Mage the Podcast, where we explore, explain, and expand on Mage the Ascension, a game that, on the whole, I think is swell. Just a note that sound leveling for group interviews is hard, and I apologize in advance if there's some audio drift across the show. And with that, on with the show. Hi, Mage fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson, with Mage the Podcast. And today, I have a distinguished panel of Mage writers, and we're going to talk about Lore of the Traditions. My guests today are developer, Travis Legg, writer, Hiromi Kota, writer, James Sombrano, and writer, this is a weird way to introduce Sataros, Sataros Filbricato. And with that, let's just kind of go off from the top. Travis, you were the dev for this. What is it like devving a book called Lore of the Traditions, and did you have any sort of overall vision for it?
It was awesome devving a book called Lore of the Traditions. It's definitely longtime Mage fan dream come true type stuff. Did I have an overall vision? Yeah, absolutely. It was to collect the best voices that are in the Mage sphere to represent the traditions as they're viewed in M20 going forward. So in a lot of ways, there's a bit Kevin Smith does where he talks about when he was directing Supergirl, you know, how it's very much more like hosting a set than it is running a set. That was kind of the way I tried to approach this dev job. I just hired well and then sat back and watched magic happen and handled some formatting stuff pretty much. It was the easiest development job I ever have and probably ever will have.
And with that, Sataros, what was it like just being the writer?
It was a big relief. Travis and I co-developed Technocracy Reloaded, and I was just a writer but consulting developer on the Technocracy Operatives Manual. I'm actually finding it a lot more fun now to just be the author and not have to be responsible for, you know, redlining and juggling 100,000 plus words worth of material and just writing, you know, 10 or 15,000 instead. And that helped me really get back the joy of working on Mage, which I was kind of losing there after Gods and Monsters.
Hiromi, this was not your first Mage rodeo. What did you get to write for Lore of the Traditions, and kind of how did you feel about that?
I got to write the Akashiana, which was a ton of fun because immediately like ran face first into a lot of cultural and linguistic issues where I'm just like, this doesn't make sense if you know much about Chinese, Japanese, Indian history. And then I'm like, I went over to Travis. I'm like, what do you want me to do with all this shit? Like, the canon was written as best as it could by the people of the time who didn't have access to Asian writers. They didn't have access to Wikipedia. They didn't have access to a lot of good resources. Canon something that we shoot bad fiction out of. And I'm like, all right, well.
Can you give an example of something where you're like, oh, your heart was in the right place, but boy, howdy, was the, like one or two things where you're like, okay, I see what you intended. We moved it from this to this.
The general trajectory of like the pre-existing lore in terms of like what events were meaningful to the Akashiana, I like that. That's more or less the same. Some of the details are a little, some of the terminology just, so like a lot of the terminology of like Shihin, Shidai, like those are specific to Kung Fu. And beyond that, they're gendered terms like Shidai and Shihin are not just junior and senior, but junior brother, older brother. It was pulled in from that. And I'm like, if we're going to go ahead and look at the Akashiana in a way that makes like sense cohesively, they're a group of people who a large number of them continuously reincarnate, and their avatar is like, hey, here's some memories that you had from another life in a body that is very fucking different from what you're in right now. There is no way that there is not a high percentage of, or at least a higher than average percentage of trans folk, especially non-binary, because once you get to that point, you're like, I've been men, I've been women. What is gender? I actually don't know. I've had too many bodies. All of this gendered stuff goes right out because it doesn't make sense to me anymore. the specifically masculine coded elements that are just all throughout the former lore, like that all had to go, because once you really analyze what they're doing, it doesn't make sense to keep it. So I'm like, okay, well, what other terms do we have in Kung Fu? They're all gendered. All right. Well, we're using Japanese because Kohai and Senpai aren't gendered, and we can just go ahead and go with that. Similarly, there were a bunch of terms within the lore that were Chinese, but not one kind of Chinese. So like there was Mandarin, there was Cantonese, there was Southern Min. I think there was Shanghaiese in one of the books. And I'm like, we have to focus on like one thing.
So it sounds like the focus of what you did was you made it make linguistic sense. And you also said one of the unifying themes of this group is they all believe in this succession of self across life, and that maybe the contemporary trappings that we use to describe what it is to be a person may not really fit. Is that reasonable to say that, that's part of the locus of what the Akashiana are now to you?
Yeah. I was careful to leave space for Akashic members who aren't reincarnations, because like if the idea is that everyone's a reincarnation, then you can't have new members. Like it's actually impossible, which I mean, from like a player basis and from like a lore basis, it's kind of boring. So I'm like, let about half reincarnate, about half are new members. Maybe they'll reincarnate this life, maybe they won't. It's really up to what happens within the game. You get to kind of explore what it means to have that kind of background and to have an avatar that's older than your physical body.
James, you and I have talked extensively about your criticisms with the Kavadi. When you were taking on updating the Dream Speakers, what was a thing that you were very pleased to get rid of, and what do you consider their focus now?
I don't know that I got rid of anything specifically, but I did very consciously choose to veer away from some aspects of the revised description of them, because they lead into some things that I really didn't think were appropriate for the tradition, including that having mental illness was a way that you would be a quote unquote shaman. And I could talk about shamanism too, but it's hard to describe to me like what it felt to me like to see that, you know, side by side you had like these kind of, in my experience growing up, these sacred and indigenous traditions with, you know, someone who has schizophrenia and saying it's the same thing. And so I kind of moved away from that, which isn't to say that you can't be a dream speaker or a Kavadi with mental illness. It's just to say that I don't think it's appropriate to say that that's a reason to join the tradition. There were some other aspects in Revised that tended to be like, let's move this away from a group of people who, you know, although they are globally spread out and have like this massive range of magical tradition, that they also are a group of people that similarly experienced a lot of colonialism. And they moved into like, let's take away that experience from them and make them like anyone from any part of the world, even if you haven't experienced colonialism, could be part of this group, because I felt like it just didn't really mesh into like where that group came from or where they were going. So like that's the closest I got to removing anything, but I would say it's more that I just recentered towards paradigmatically looking at what it is to be part of an animist tradition, and more specifically to move away from how you interact with animism, from being like all dream speakers are shamans to like shamanism is one avenue, and it's probably not even the most common one. I talked a lot about protocol, which previously I think only hermetics really dive into, but my experience, I'm not going to go into a lot of like individual personal detail, but my experience witnessing those traditions is that protocol is deeply important when you're from indigenous groups too. So I talked about the importance of that paradigmatically. So one thing that I don't know if a lot of people know, but when Seder was first developing the whole line, the first book of the line, we talked a lot about it, and we talked a lot specifically about dream speakers too. And I have like these memories of, they're loose at this point. It's been a couple of years.
Yeah, but, like eight.
Yeah, it's been a long time. But I remember we talked about a lot of stuff, but them specifically a lot. And one thing I really wanted to like get a chance to dive into more deeply was the new faction, the Akin Kanju. And because I remember us talking about that, because we were part of the like central theme of those talks we had were like, we wanted to move away from the Dream Speakers being depicted as like, we're just healers and we're here to help the world and we're going to cleanse things. And you know, we're moving away from the Fern Gully depiction, the Avatar depiction of the Dream Speakers, and into like, hey, you know what? Sometimes you pick up the fucking rifle and get wide eye off your property because fuck them. And so that was like the Akin Kanju like barely gets like a sentence, I think, in the core book, maybe two. And so like I specifically tried to explore that through one of the NPCs that's in there is Akin Kanju, who is a professor who studies like psychology and self-empowerment and how to use language to strengthen your culture and your heritage. I'm also exploring the Akin Kanju in another upcoming unnamed release a little bit more deeply with a couple more NPCs too. And hopefully giving the players an idea of what that faction is like without writing like a faction section so they can see what they might do with them. But like, I guess the concept of like self-empowerment through reclamation and decolonization is the emphasis of that group.
It's kind of interesting because in M20, the Dream Speakers, the Kavadi, are some of the only ones to actually get factions named in their tradition write-ups. We have them and like the Hermetics. I mean, you only got two pages and half of it is art and a title. There's only so much you can do. But I thought that was kind of interesting. So it sounds like you are narrowing what you consider the Dream Speakers to be a little bit. Is the magic in response to the colonial experience kind of a locus? Is that the core of it? Or is that just kind of a theme?
I don't know that I can say it's the core because I think the experience of being... So the way I see the Dream Speakers at their core is that they are animists. Like, that's primarily what you're looking at. They exist in this weird space in Mage because we're inarguably with the other traditions, conventions, and crafts in Mage. You can say like, well, their belief is just their belief. Like, you know, you don't know, like, of course, like the conceit of Mage is you believe it and it's real. But the weird thing about the Dream Speakers is that the kind of canon setting of the World of Darkness established that spirits are real and they do exist everywhere and are in everything. So like, it's inarguable that their belief system is real. It is. The whole premise of the World of Darkness says that they're right. And so I kind of just focus on that aspect of like what it is to be the kind of person who believes that spirits are in everything. Because even though the World of Darkness establishes that's real, like not everything in the World of Darkness like behaves that way. Like our big, you know, top setting is vampire. And like, I would say like 99% of vampires don't even know what spirits are. But it is real, right? It's like, it doesn't need magic to be real. It's just part of the setting.
When there was that thing going around saying happy birthday to vampire, I wanted to send out a thing like, thank you for putting down the groundwork for Stephen Wick to look at this and go, this is cool, but I can do better. I don't think the family would have loved that, but that was just kind of my first thought.
Did you have a lot of family listening to this podcast? Because like you could put the sign in the window that says that the family would be mad if they could even read. Sorry. So sorry. Don't get mad at me, family. I love you.
And Sataros, you have been the signature character, in my mind at least, for the Cultists of Ecstasy for nigh on 30 years at this point.
Can't imagine why.
Yeah, I don't think you were involved in the revised recasting of them.
Nope.
What was it like to kind of take the tradition and say, what did you get rid of or shed that you thought was inappropriate for the time? And what did you kind of feel is the core of the Sahagia now?
Way back when I first... when I first started working on Mage, the Cult of Ecstasy, the Occult of Ecstasy, the Akashic Brotherhood at that time, the Dream Speakers and the Euthanatos were the groups that annoyed the shit out of me because they were obviously, they didn't work. And so when I worked on the Cult of Ecstasy tradition book, I wanted to get into the head of the cult of the ecstatics and show that they're not just sex, drugs, and rock and roll mages. Yes, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are a part of that tradition, but that down below that superficial level that everybody sees, there's a lot more going on there. Now, back when I wrote the original Cult of Ecstasy tradition book, a lot of that was still theoretical for me in life. I mean, I'd done a number of psychoactives and, you know, had kind of played in bands and stuff like that. But a lot of the things that I was talking about in terms of Tantra and in terms of, you know, like hitchhiking around the country and things like that, I'd gone to Burning Man a few months before I wrote the Cult of Ecstasy tradition book, which, you know, is kind of obvious in hindsight. But at the time, I was trying to keep it quiet because Burning Man was not yet a thing that like everybody knew about. And I didn't want to be the one to spoil it. In between, when I was writing that book, because I wrote that book in like 2.5 weeks because the original author choked up a hairball and I had to run with it. So a lot of the stuff in there, I found as I was writing it, I was going, wow, I'd love to do that. Or this would be so cool. Wouldn't it be neat if, and you know, it's very personal, but at the same time, it was also very aspirational. In between the original Cult of Ecstasy tradition book and writing this section for Lore of the Traditions, I actually did all that shit. After divorcing both White Wolf and my then wife, Wendy, I went and said, okay, fuck it. I'm going to do all this. I dated a few tantricas. I did the festival thing, got involved with a number of sacred sexuality groups, dance groups, got heavy into the ecstatic dance scene and so forth, and started playing in bands again. And so when I came around the next time, almost 20 years later, to do it came from a much more practical experience, real life experience, instead of just theory and coming up with stuff off the books on my shelf. And also I had a lot of experience, both good and bad. And so I wanted to address the downside, that lifestyle, those beliefs. And also the world has changed quite a bit since the 90s. When I went back to reread the first edition Cult of Ecstasy book, I was glad to see that consent was still a really big thing in the first edition, but I wanted to emphasize the shit out of it because that has become a major conversation since the 90s. And I wanted to, in the update, I wanted to present a cult that was cult. I get rid of the cult part for starters, but I wanted to address the Sahaya as a group of people who are determined to stay ethical. In real life, I ran into a lot of people in those communities who were not ethical and had some fairly unfortunate experiences. So when I came back to them in Mage 20, both in Lore of the Traditions and in Mage 20 in general, I was like, no, ethical is important. Ethical is vital, because otherwise you just have the cult of rapes to see. And I have no desire to be either associated with a group like that or to write about a group like that. At the same time, I also have very strong feelings about the Care Bear world of everybody's doing everything right. No, that's not the way it works. I felt it was important to emphasize that this group does have a really, really ugly side, and to take that on, to face that head on and make that a major element of my section. The people who are going, no, really seriously, we want to be ethical, and the people who are going, no, man, don't fence me in. You're infringing on my rights. You're infringing on my freedom, because then it's not ecstasy if I have to follow all these rules. And so that's a major theme within my chapter. It was there in the original Cult of Ecstasy book. It's addressed more in Lore of the Traditions, and I also wanted to address more the issue of cultural appropriation, which, especially when you're dealing with the COE, especially, good old Uncle Al there, just kind of running around the occult tourists of the 1800s and 1900s and the hippies for that matter. And I wanted to, and one of the characters featured in there, it was flat out addresses the, if you respect the culture, if you respect the tradition, fine, but don't fuck around with my people's sacred culture. And if you're going to say that this element of this culture is important to you and it's part of your enlightenment, then fucking respect the culture and fucking respect the people. And there's a character in there who's flat out like, yeah, fucking respect the culture, fucking respect the people, or else.
So Travis, you had 9 submissions or so to work with. And I imagine some people had different definitions of what a tradition was. In 1E, they were generally somewhat monolithic. In Revised, they were almost political and they were more adjectives. Cultist of Ecstasy Revised makes mention of saying, how could we kick out the Agori from the Cult of Ecstasy? It's not on us to kick them out. We are a descriptor. That's like saying, Jim's an asshole. He's not an accountant anymore. You can't do that. What was it like kind of reconciling those visions?
We kind of all, I feel very fortunate that I've had the opportunity to work on several now at this point, Mage 20 books. And I never, ever want to let an opportunity pass to point out that I'm working from a very, very solid foundation, Satiros built.
Both figuratively and literally, it is
right.
Quite massive.
Right, yeah. I mean, you could build a house on top of an M20 book, that's true. But specifically, the way that the traditions are presented in that book, I think very clear as to what they are and what they are not. And I felt like all the authors very well followed along with that. I was very pleasantly surprised as we went through the process because I very much wanted to encourage every author to bring their voice, to prioritize what they felt. I know Jeff and I had some early conversations about the way that historically the dream speakers are presented in a voice that's not very accurate to the way that people of that tradition might speak. And since speaker is in the name, seems appropriate to just kind of get out the way and let someone who knows a little bit more about that handle that. And I honestly was pleasantly surprised that that was able to get through the various stages of approval and the various stages of making a book happen with all of those voices intact and able to sort of present them in those ways. There were some tricks that I used in terms of handing out that permission. One of the things that I believe I said to everyone on this call and a couple other authors was, when in doubt, just blame the Order of Hermes. There's a whole big point of pinning on them this sort of, we're going to shove everyone into a box, whether they like it or not. You might not be a hermetic house, but we're still going to make you fit in this box. Several mages back in the Grand Convocation said, yeah, up your nose with a rubber hose, I'm not doing it, and took off. But everybody who's kind of stuck around got stuck in those boxes. So that makes for a nice in-world explanation as to why you have, you know, linguistic fuckery going on in the Akashiana, why you have people that aren't maybe experienced with the cultures of the dream speakers doing the talking, because maybe those were the ones that were the least inclined to sit back and just watch this sort of nonsense the hermetics were spewing. You always have that to fall back on going into this book. And my hope is that after you read this book, now you'll be able to say, oh, well, now I can see where some of those places were, and now I can see those voices poking through that sort of smothering blanket of hermetic thought. It was kind of the central end.
A smothering blanket of hermetic thought sounds like a 5-point wonder. So I look forward to that getting a write-up somewhere. Going through that, so we've kind of talked about like, what did we want to clear away and kind of make the new focus? But at the end of the day, Mage is fundamentally a game about looking at the sphere system and saying, hey, storyteller, are you going to buy this bullshit? And the storyteller going, yeah, I'll let you. Let's not forget what the RPG focus of this game can be. What were the most enjoyable bits to add? Like any bits of research that you found or bits of magic that you got to inject? Like, Hiromi, you're covering a comical spread in terms of sheer percentage of the human population. Was there anything in particular you were like, look, I did my homework. Here are my receipts. Play my game.
I had a ton of that, actually. I think the thing that like comes most readily to mind was that a lot of older names for like specific Kashiks were like these odd things like battering ram and smoke tiger. And yes, these names mean things, but they're also names, and like you're exoticizing Asian names for like no good reason. So I'm just gonna give people names, and like some of them are going to be their birth names they decided to keep around. Some of them are going to be monastic names that they were given when they were apprenticing. And this is like straight from my draft. Lore of the Tradition avoids the practice of exoticizing names for the same reason that books written by Westerners don't refer to Samuel Haight as Name of God from Atop the Hill. Because that's what his fucking name means, and no one calls him that. They call him Sam the fucking Ashtray.
Are there any bits of magic you were pleased to introduce, like maybe a rote or a sphere interpretation or a wonder or something, like what I will call a useful magic-y table bit?
Don't know that I created rotes specifically, but I did end up getting into like the instruments and practices with the idea that you have an avatar that's much, much older than you. That's going to be one of your instruments, because it's going to be like, oh, hey, how did I used to do this rote? Oh, right. Thanks, avatar. Tea manipulation is all over. It's all over Asia. Like, it's finding countries or finding cultures that don't have some kind of belief about energy and how you can manipulate it either through the environment or through yourself. That's a big part of Asian magic. And so I'm like, this needs to go in here. I think I was originally going to introduce that in Technocracy Reloaded, but there just wasn't word count for it. Although in Technocracy Reloaded, there would have been a fun real-life reference to a pair of banks in, I want to say Hong Kong, where one of them just didn't adhere to feng shui. And so like their building was just sort of like spewing bad chi all over the place. And so their rival bank across town was like, okay, well, we're going to build essentially chi cannons, sit them on top of our building and shoot the bad chi back at you, you fuckers. This really happened. Why is this not in Mage? Why?
Those are atop the HSBC building.
Yes. Yeah.
After the nearby Bank of China Tower was completed, two cannon-like structures were mounted on HSBC building to deal with that. And that's also why I think in Hong Kong there are buildings that just have kind of large holes in their design or weird geometric things to accord with harmonious design principles.
The idea is that if you're allowed chi to flow through, then it promotes good chi. Whereas if you're starting to like block it and hem it in, then it gets turmoil. That's just not good for anybody.
James, was there anything in particular you were pleased to add in or that you thought was particularly neat?
I wrote a couple rotes in mind with the intent of trying to show you like different ways that, because again, the more complicated thing about the Dream Speakers is it's literally like thousands upon thousands of different real world traditions being thrown together into one group. So I was just trying to give some ideas of what that could look like in ways that haven't really been shown in the books before. But also Travis mentioned the way that I wrote the history section, and it was the very first thing I asked about, because kind of the common thinking when you're writing a history would be like start at the beginning, get to the middle, and then the end. But in a lot of these traditions, storytelling is non-linear, and storytelling is the way that you keep history. And so I intentionally wrote like the history chapter for the Kavadi is told like a combination of story and song. Like I can't really produce it as song in the written format, but that's how I envisioned it as I was writing it. I kind of take key points in their history and say, like, here is a creation story. Here is the importance of Nioba's death, a few things like that. But I present them connected, but not linear, and in a way where I was hoping to like make it really evocative, like a lot of the cultural thinking that goes on behind this tradition. I also tried to have each aspect of this story told in a slightly different voice, and I used like different indigenous and tribal languages tied to like point that out as I went through it. I only personally, how much I speak of those languages is pretty minimal. I speak a little bit of my own from the two tribes that I come from. And so it was a huge amount of research trying to make sure I was presenting those things in ways that weren't ridiculous, as Hidomi had to discover for some of their stuff, right? I just tried really hard to like show you this image of who the Kavadi are without it just being all like drum beats and headdresses, which is, you know, they've either been presented that way or they've been presented as crazy people who see things. And like, I don't like either of those things. And so I just tried to give like just really deep dive into like, what does it look like to be inside one of these many thousands of magical practices?
And can you give an example of like one of those insights that you grant or one of the recommendations you make to people actually at the table?
Yeah, sure. One of the things I mentioned is the art of danza, or practicing as a danzante. What that is, it's a Mexican practice where it's not the same as, but I would say like for people who aren't Mexican and listening, I would compare this to powwow dancing. It's not the same, but to give you an idea, like you dress in like some more quote unquote traditional garb, not necessarily like what people wore then, but it's definitely like something that's giving a nod to like what your Indian ancestry is. And you perform dances that are meant to be sacred spiritual connection to your ancestors so that you can teach like the language, which includes dance, because dance is a language, the language of your ancestors to your children, so that you are imparting that sacred knowledge that comes from before you into the future through the form of dance. Go, if you're listening to this podcast, take a moment. I would actually say a really good place to look to get just some quick images and like what I'm talking about is just go to TikTok and look up danzante, and you'll find some gorgeous short videos of what that looks like.
Zatoros, what did you make the magic of the Cultus of Ecstasy, Sahagia?
Yeah.
So
Sahagia, actually, I'm mispronouncing it. It's my dyslexia messes with me on that word, but Sahagia.
What does their magic look like now to you? Is there any particular bit that you were pleased to add or put in to the Mage Toolbox for a member of the tradition?
I ended up having to cut a lot of the stuff that I wrote for that chapter because I just left, wrote sort of things out entirely because, one, there wasn't word count, and two, a lot of the stuff is covered anyway in a lot of the stuff that they could, that they do is already covered in How Do You Do That. The things I'm really pleased about is I added a number of paradigms and practices, but I really wanted to get into the idea of antinomianism and the night side, which are talked about a bit in Book of the Fallen, or actually talked about a lot in Book of the Fallen, but tying in how that is done, how ethical mages do that, ethical practitioners do it, and bringing in a number of new paradigms, like I said, the practice of shadow work and theogens as a tool, the idea of, you know, it's the idea of chemicals, not just as a drug due to like get high, but discussing how entheogens are used in a magical and in a sacred way, and also approaching Tantra, which is also talked about very briefly in the Book of the Fallen from the non-fallen standpoint, because that's a huge element of the ecstatic path, where the ecstatic path draws heavily from Tantra. Talk a bit about sigils and so forth. And I wanted to get into techno ecstasy and so forth. And there's some stuff I really wanted to play with, but I ended up, like I said, having to cut that and probably expand it into a storyteller's guide book, a storyteller's vault rather book, theoretically calling Fragments of Ecstasy or Shards of Ecstasy.
Those are things that kind of already exist in the core of the game. Is there a new tool that is in the toolbox that you feel? I think Tantra was kind of one of the, I recall that being mentioned in the core, but it doesn't get a heavy treatment of that. Can you give, for people who might not be familiar, like maybe just a one or two sentence description of what that is?
Tantra is essentially the practice of weaving, the practice of interconnection, where Western magic is often thought of, I read this thing and I cast this spell. In Tantra, the idea is that the practitioner or multiple practitioners become part of each other, and by extension join with the divine and join with the divine energies. To be, you know, really super reductionist about an incredibly complex practice, where Western magic is, you know, very individualistic, Tantra is specifically about getting beyond yourself and connecting with something and someone bigger than yourself.
Yeah, I mean, we have Tantra as kind of being an Eastern esoteric tradition, which in a lot of cases we're not really necessarily used to looking at as Westerners. So seeing that on the page, I think is going to be really neat.
I also address how what we in America specifically think of as Tantra is a sexual toolkit that is just a little itty bitty piece of a much larger, much broader and at some points even ascetic practice. And so I differentiate between those two and say, you know, the ecstatics have room for both, but it's bigger than just, you know, sting, you know, having sex for 12 hours.
Yeah, it's kind of like when someone says they do yoga, which to me is the equivalent of saying I speak language.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, oh, well, yeah. This is a term for an entire class of practices. Like, oh,
some
what do
people
you do?
Say, I like curry. I'm like,
yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah. Travis, when you get all these bits in, do you have any sort of fact-checking process that you have when people are like, I'm revising the history of that? Like, was there a point where you or someone else kind of had to be like the lore master for something like this? Because I know there are a few cases where I made an offhanded reference to that. You're like, well, actually, I'm like, oh, I got well actually by Travis. He's paying attention to me.
I don't pretend to be a lore monger. I never have been. I never will. There are bits of the lore that I adore, and there are things that I'll, you know, if something strikes me as funny, I'll double check it or whatever. I had a couple of very succinct mission statements, things that I wanted to accomplish, but I don't necessarily think that they were as much in adhering to quote unquote canon, because as I told Hiromi, you know, canon is what you fire, you know, bad ideas out of or bad players. Things that are highly well established, if they have a lot of page count devoted to them earlier, I wanted to really make sure that if we were skewing those, that we were skewing them in a way that made sense. I'll just pick on you because you're the host. We had a discussion about Alan Turing and how to reconcile what we know as historically true in the really real world with what Mage presents and make all that make sense. And I think we came up with a pretty elegant. One of the things that I made sure to do when I was approaching people about the book was bring on people who knew what they were talking about. You know, I wasn't trying to bring on anyone that was unfamiliar with Mage. I wasn't too concerned about it. you know, and I also figured if I went too far afield, Dawkins would just, you know, reach across the Atlantic and slap me.
It was a weird thing being able to write on it and doing, being someone who does a Mage podcast, the inconsistencies are a gift. Once you realize that it's so big that not everything can agree with everything else, it kind of gives you a freedom to do whatever and not really feel that bad about it. If you have three different books that all give different dates for the whiteout of the digital web, I feel like I can't have a wrong answer. And I think that as a storyteller, that's kind of great. And like if two different origin stories or two different death dates for a character are done, it's like, okay, guess I have options. It's not like it's Vampire where like we have entire books of like mage lineages or anything like that where people are like, but you said it was the seventh gens.
Well, another thing that, again, I want to give all credit to the writers because the writers came with their A game. But one of the strengths of this book is the experience when you look at the virtual adepts versus the experience when you look at the Kavadi versus the experience when you look at the Kashyana. They're all being spoken in their own voice. So that means you've got a lot of hard dates in that Order of Hermes chapter, man. Yeah. There's bullet points in that chapter. But, you know, you get into the Dream Speaker chapter, you get into the Cult chapter, it's more fluid. Again, you know, this is the other thing that I try desperately to convey to people who are, I'm talking to them online about Mage, or if they're at my table when we're playing Mage, like, you're dealing with a reality where whoever's will is the strongest gets to dictate what's true, you're going to have contradictions. You have an entire tradition whose whole jam is fucking with the flow of time. It's not always going to, you know, things are not going to be consistent. You're going to have contradictions. There's a whole system about that called paradox.
One of the pillars of Mage's, you know, approach and design is Rashomon, you know, where you have four different versions of the same thing and they all contradict each other and people throw up their hands and go, which one is true? That's the question, isn't it?
It's something for your players to sort out at the table. Some of the best times I've ever had playing Mage were 4 hours sitting around a table at a Denny's in this cloud of Newport smoke and bad coffee, listening to nine players have 12 opinions about how something ought to go. While I just sat there chain smoking and enjoying my moons over my hammy.
So another thing that gets a fair amount of word count is the, kind of the who's who, like who is active in the tradition of Kern or any key figures. Does anyone have a favorite character they either got to revise, spend time with, or add?
I don't remember what his name used to be. It would be similar to Hyunmyung Sunim. I had to change the name because, one, it was written with an outdated Korean to English transliteration system, and two, because it was spelled wrong.
The former Primus, Kim Yong-sunim?
Because War in Heaven is one of those things where, like, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, depending on someone's individual chronicle. I have two versions of him. One of them is that he grew up, had all of his horrible childhood issues. And I also corrected some history there because his original backstory was that he was the last emperor of, I know this history.
Like the Joseon Dynasty or something like that?
Yes, Joseon Dynasty.
Okay.
He was supposed to be the last emperor of the Joseon Dynasty, except the Joseon Dynasty didn't have emperors until like 300 years after he was born. So that doesn't fucking work. Also, it existed for, like, up until the Empire of Japan came about because the Meiji Restoration modernized Japan, and they're like, oh, we're in a better position to do everything than anyone else in Asia, so we're just going to fucking take everyone over and learn all of the bad things from Western imperialists and create Eastern imperialism. I cleaned that up, and if he's still alive, if he's still the Primus, then he's in a much better position to be able to guide the tradition. If he's not, Warren was long enough ago that he's back. I gave him the same name, Hyunmyung, but not Sunim, because that's a specific title in Korean Buddhism. If you tell this kid, if you call him Sunim, he's going to get real embarrassed because he doesn't think he's earned it, because in a sense, he hasn't. This version of Hyunmyung is Korean-American trans man from Oakland, and he, part of his awakening was being really good at rap battle, which takes us back to before we started recording. And the idea was that he used this ability to just like have mind effects through his emceeing to connect disparate groups, to connect gangs. So like he kind of grew up in a rough spot, and part of this might have gotten cut for word count. Maybe it didn't. When the Akashiana finally showed up in his house and was like, oh, it's Hyunjung. We need to recruit him. There was a bit of a language barrier and a little bit of understanding barrier. And his mom thought that they were trying to recruit him to a Korean label. And so she's like, yes, but my son wants to be a star. Yes. Get him to the training camp. Go ahead and run him through the exercises. That's what he wants to do. I'm going to support it. And then she finally understood, oh, you're sending him to a monastery. Well, that's way less interesting. But I mean, he's still into it. So he's still really excited about what you're promising. So, okay, sure. But it would have been cooler if you Akashics were actually a record label.
Do we get that? Do you pay off that at some point?
He's young enough that it can happen.
Okay, got it. It left as a plot hook, as it were.
Yeah, if you want to take Hyunmyung and like, he's finished his Sidai period, but just has. So like he's still working, kind of like bouncing between Korea and SoCal, and just being like, we're going to teach how to mediate between groups that are some amounts of uncooperative to hostile to each other. And a lot of that's through emceeing. So if you really want to have a magic hip-hop group, here you go. Go for it.
James, were there any characters that you got to add or update that you're particularly pleased by?
Yeah, but first I just wanted to quickly expand upon something Hidomi hinted at there, that before we started recording, they, Sater and myself, engaged in a pretty bitter rap battle that I unabashedly won, just trounced them into the dirt. That said,
that is available as special content for our Patreon.
Yeah, it's the top, it's the $30 a month Patreon,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah.
In the main book, I actually chose to primarily show you a couple, like I really dove into a couple of newer characters. One of them is actually a really old character, but it's like two sentences in a changeling book that no one will ever read. So like
Rage Across Appalachia.
No, actually, I almost took a character from that, but that's not what it is. But I almost did. There's a dream speaker in that book. So the thing that I kind of explored the most was when you're exploring the meta plot of Mage, and you have to think about the Avatar Storm, if the Avatar Storm is something you're sticking with, whatever version of it is that you're sticking with. I kind of talked about how if you really think about it, no one really gets hit harder by that than the Kavadi, because they've invested more of their traditions, time, energy, and resources into building up their connections to the Umbra than anyone else by far. You know, you might argue like, oh, well, Duisetep's a big deal. Sure. I still don't think that is going to compare to all of the different horizon zones and stuff that the Dream Speakers have been mentioned to like maintain over the books. They have so many mentioned in all the books that some of them don't even have names. They're just kind of acknowledged to exist. So I talked about how if you're running with Avatar Store having happened, like what happens to not only the Lodge of the Gray Squirrel, but also the Primus at the time, Laughing Eagle, and kind of built in, you know, some ideas about what could have happened. Like actually Hidomi and I worked on that together a lot, because unspoken book that is also potentially happening, it gets explored a lot more deeply. And so we worked together a lot on that. Partially because his original description was like, this is an Apache man who looks like a Plains Indian. I'm like, we're not Plains Indians. Apaches aren't Plains Indians. Sorry.
We wrote that book in 3 weeks.
It's okay. You know, I'm just teasing you. What I really wanted to get into, though, was like I talked about like maybe, you know, what could have happened to this character, but mostly in order to kind of bring in who a more contemporary leadership of the tradition might look like. And I intentionally kind of pulled back to the concept of the original leadership of the Kavadi, which was a dual leadership that I think one other tradition, someone can correct me, might have engaged in that, but mostly is not very common. And I thought it made a lot of sense because there is a lot of like indigenous leadership styles that have multiple leaders for different reasons. And so I really wanted to like come back to that idea because I thought it was really good. And like, honestly, Smithson didn't have that much done with him outside of the one book for the most part anyway. So it wasn't like a big loss to like write him out either. And so you'll get to see a little bit of exploration into like what the future leadership of the Kavadi might look like and how that creates more internal tension and less like peace, love, and harmony, which I was really trying to pull away from with their depiction in the first place.
Satyros, is there anyone that you added or really got to bring to the front that you were pleased with?
I've always loved Lynn Davis's character, Leanne Milner, which obviously I ran with Leanne and John Courage as sort of the bookend representatives of the Mage 20 line. And in the description, obviously she's the Primus now. So in the description, I brought her from the, you know, from the kind of the kid that she was in her original appearance in the Cult of Ecstasy revised into being the, you know, basically the master of the ecstatic arts that she is now for better and worse. She's a wonderful character, and I couldn't do her justice in two paragraphs, but I always love working her in. My favorite creation in this, other than updating the code of Ananda, which desperately needed it, was the character Devika Kumari Shravana, who is sort of brings in the newer and reform oriented element of the COE, which is of the ecstatic tradition under any name, in where she's kind of the young generation going, you know, so about you sex, drugs, and rock and roll cultural tourists, how about if you not? And worked her up with my friends Saban and Ajit, and to make sure that there were not the embarrassing cultural and linguistic mistakes that cropped up so often in earlier books, but at the same time making her a fun character and not just a stereotype one way or the other.
Travis, I don't know if you can answer this, but how do you figure out how long a book is going to be? All of these groups had been like 35,000 words or something like that in the 1E tradition books. And then in revised, they got 50 to 72,000 if you were Malcolm Shepard. And now our ultimate word count or group was a little bit less than 10. What does that discussion look like to figure out how big a book's going to be?
It really depends book to book. It depends on kind of what the general mission statement is coming down from the top, but that can vary drastically depending on what line you're on. And this one in particular, and I could be misremembering this, so don't take this as like holy writ by any stretch, I think Dawkins told me what word count to try to hit when I wrote the pitch. But that, and that does happen. But there are also, you know, other factors. Every once in a while, you'll pitch a book and you'll just be like, I think we should do this many words. But honestly, like the way that it broke down is really just because I like having things to be like clear cut, clean. Everybody gets, you know, X, Y, Z. And so that's how the word count kind of came about. It was just the math. And I would have loved to have had 10 times the word count, but you know, there are realities of publishing to consider. It was one in a volley of books that were pitched at the time. I believe some of those will be piggybacking on the Kickstarter, but you'll know because you're listening to this in the future when the Kickstarter has already been underway.
So it sounds like it is a mix of publishing things. A book at a certain size has a certain cost, and we have a certain price point that we want to do. A question of economy, that it can't be Lore of the Clans, which was over 300 pages, plus Lore of the Bloodlines, which was another 100 and something pages. And this was also notable because this is not presented using in-world fiction. Like a lot of the previous ones were just diegetic conversations between characters, and then there were brief asides. This is kind of our first big dose of tradition information that is presented in-world, but like Book of the Fallen, is directly addressed towards the storyteller or towards the reader. And that lets you get to the point like a good bit faster, which I certainly appreciated.
And anybody that's on this call can feel free to correct me if I'm telling tales out of school. But I think that the meat and potatoes, for lack of a better term, of Mage has been covered, and that the Technocracy Reloaded kind of was the dovetail on that covering of that. With the exception of, I would sure love to do a book about Marauders. Aside from that, because I got opinions. But aside from that, the meat and potatoes has been covered. So now we're getting the good stuff. We're getting the dessert of Mage 20. I had to say the writing is on the wall. There will eventually be a fifth edition of Mage, and it will go off into the night with Paradox. But we're in a position now where we're getting to do all the fun stuff. We're getting all the dessert. We're getting all the extra. So really delivering that in bits that are digestible, that are of value, to me, it's a lot more useful to a storyteller to have 10,000 words per tradition that really gives you a strong feel of what that tradition is overall and what that tradition has been overall and where those conflicts lie, their past, where those conflicts lie with the already voluminous text about those traditions, than it is to tack on 20,000 more words of in-character conversations. And that's no dig on Lore of the Clans or anything like that. I just don't think that's what this line needs at this point.
In complete contravention to what Travis just said, if you had been given another 10,000 words or 5,000 words, is there something that you really wish you could have added or wish you had space to do, Hiromi, James, or Satyrus?
I could have gone on and on and on, but I do that.
Storyteller Vault! I think we should have a book called Lore of the Traditions. And that just includes all of that cut material. So that's my opinion.
I wrote about roughly 15,000 words and cut it down to roughly 10.
I will be talking about the Virtual Adepts elsewhere, but early on, James was like my guide for this. I had three dots in Mage Mentor in the forms of James Sembrano, so thank you so much for that. And initially, I'm like, I'm writing the fucking Virtual Adepts. How can I do 2,000 words on their history? 2 weeks later, I send a message to James saying, I have 2,000 words of history on the Virtual Adepts, and I am at literally the year 65 CE.
It do be like that. You
I have not gotten to like, the invention of paper yet.
One thing that I welcome the various opinions that are on the panel to chime in on, but one thing that I wrangled into Technocracy Reloaded and I'm very proud of, and wrangled into Lore of the Traditions a bit too, is kind of this overarching idea that mages are kind of looking around at the world as it sits right now and going like, oh shit, we really pooched this, like in a big bad way, especially the technocracy, but kind of everybody looking around and going, oh, maybe the enemy's not the guy on the other side of the street that thinks magic works different. Maybe the enemy's human ignorance and we better do something about it quick before we are arguing over who's the best mage on the cinder. If I had extra word count to blow at something, I would have directed it at that. And I know that I was really pleased to see the way that I don't think any of the writers gave the Ascension War like a pass in addressing that concept. Like, how do you reach across the table after all this crap? So that would, to me, that'd be a very fun idea to explore. Cause I do think, you know, for what it's worth, my two cents, I think that's where the most interesting conflicts that one can tell with a mage story right now is. How do you and I put aside our differences to stop those assholes from scorching us off the face of the planet? It's enemy mine. That's where the best mage storytelling is going forward is, are you going to play Louis Cassett Jr.? Or are you going to play
Dennis Quaid? Okay. I know that through its Star Trek Next Generation incarnation, where a Romulan and a Federation member need to cooperate. One of the things baked into your outline was unlikely alliances. It is easy for me to come up with how the Order of Hermes and the Society of Aether through House Thig or something like that would get along. It takes a bit more lift as a storyteller for me to figure out how the Akashiana and the Sisters of Hippolyta may have something where they really see eye to eye that the outsider may not know unless they had that deep background. Did anyone have an example of that they thought was particularly neat or interesting? Or alternatively, was there something you would have added if you had another?
I talked a lot there's like a whole bunch in my section, but I specifically pointed out between the Kavadi and the Akashiana, how even though their worldview is practically the opposite, because the Kavadi is like there's God in everything, essentially, right? God is an evil object, and the Akashiana, like, everything is an illusion, is a reflection of the self. The place that they do meet is ancestor reverence, and it gives them so much in common in a lot of ways to start stories about, like, why they might be working together.
Looping back to your question about, like, what things we would have added or expanded upon, and for me, that would have been getting more into, like, the individuals within the Akashiana, especially because when I started doing the faction breakdown and talking about, like, the Shiren and Vajrapani and Lehi, I made sure to pull at some strings that have been loose for a while. A lot of characters that we have names for and that we've seen in the previous lore are Chinese, whereas the Akashiana is supposed to be starting from like the Ganges Valley on up, at least like originally and since then globally. And so I'm like, well, we're going to go ahead and find members from across Asia to see where they would fit within this group. And so I started bringing in Vietnamese representation, Tibetan, Indian. I want to say I had an Indonesian person in there.
I wanted to jump on what Hiromi said, though, and say that the place that I also struggled with word count was I would have desperately loved to have like another, I don't know, 2,000 words just talk about the factions, because I feel like this is true for every tradition. Like, so I'm not trying to like say it's just the one I wrote, but it is definitely especially true for the Kavadi that like factions give you an opportunity to talk about the fact that, you know, I'm going to mention this again, like the Kavadi are a collection of thousands and thousands of real world traditions. And so they give you an opportunity to like be like, hey, you know, here's a deep dive into all these different ways they have of looking at the world, the different politics they have. And on top of that, I would have loved to talk about why I don't think solitaries and independents make good Kavadi faction, because all those cultures are so community focused. So like, I'm like, why would you be completely disconnected from everyone when like the whole reason you engage in that kind of spirituality is to build and protect your community.
I wish we could do at some point a book that is just about the divisions within, because, you know, as we've talked about before, I would have loved to have put that into Mage 20, but the math was formidable.
You had to cut so much already.
I ran a brief thing, and it even if I'd only given each faction, you know, 200 or 300 words, which anybody who's written anything, you know, knows 200 or 300 words is nothing, that still would have ended up with all of the various factions that have been mentioned in various mage books. That would have been close to 200,000 words, just that. And I would love to do, at some point be able to have us do a book just dealing with the various different groups within the traditions.
But everyone go back Lore of Traditions so that we can pitch Lore of the Factions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go tell them on the Kickstarter. Go tell them the Kickstarter right now. Be like, we want these writers specifically.
Right. Lore of the Factions.
Do Lore of the Factions. I want Terry Robinson to write about all the different Celestial Chorus factions, because I think they have more than anyone, including the Hermetics.
When we get to the point where we can have a conversation about the weird wonders, I got to come back on, and you got to make sure that me and JF are on the show, because we had a hell of a conversation about some road ideas. That alone would be a great podcast.
I would be glad to. Travis, Hiromi, James, and Sataros, thank you so much for your time. Are there any current projects that you're working on that maybe we can have you back to talk about when maybe they're closer to publishing? Travis and I are going to do a book on the Marauders, and James and I are going to do a book on the factions. So I'm pretty jazzed about that.
Official, you heard it here first.
I've made some weird offer just to mage writers. That's all I'm saying. It's like
Scarlands. Go buy Scarlands things all the time.
I've got my collection of short fiction, Valhalla with a Twist of Leaf, which has been probably by the time this airs have been available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and DriveThru and so forth for about a year. By the time this airs, my novel Red Shoes, which is not mage, it is my stuff, but that should probably be out by the time this goes live. So please go look for Red Shoes, my urban fantasy novel, the first of the River Haven series. And I'm also working on a new project called Creatures of the Wood, which may or may not have gone public by the time this broadcasts. I've at least started talking about it publicly, and I'm having a fucking blast with that one.
And links to everyone's Twitter and any extant Patreons will also be in our show notes. Hiromi, did you have anything that you wanted to promote?
I'm the incoming Scion line dev, so like all of the Scion stuff.
Congrats.
Scion God's coming out. I mean, it's in red lines right now. It probably won't be out by the time this airs. There's a very slim chance of that, but other Scion goodness is out. Tales of Resistance, which is a bunch of queer short stories in various genres. From that ended up spinning off At an End, which is not mage, but it's not mage. If you like mage and you like mage fiction, you should do the thing. And if you want a queer take on military fiction, Smoke and Mirrors, Cold Trail is not Hunter, but it's not Hunter. It is essentially a group of diverse mercenaries who have ethics, which, you know, that field needs.
Yep. As I am always working on a host of various OPP books that are coming out, I don't even know which ones will be coming out at this point. probably something that Travis mentioned, probably something that Hiromi already mentioned. I'm probably on one of those. Also, I was one of the main writers and developers on Transformers, the role-playing game, which I am deeply proud of and excited about. And I'm hoping that around the time this comes out, like maybe we'll be doing some like live plays and stuff like that. And I would love to do one myself. I don't know if I'm going to be at that point. I hope I am. But like, let's see. Like, I'm really excited about Transformers. Go check it out from Renegade Game Studios and see the kind of work that, you know, I can do talking about robot cars. I had a lot of fun.
I can't imagine that was anything but a blast.
It was so fun. It was. They did three Hasbro franchises games, and it was Power Rangers, G.I. Joe, and Transformers, and I got on the best one, unquestionably.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
This has been Made to the Podcast, where if you don't hear from me for a while, it's because my preview of The Celestial Chorus is out, and I've coincidentally joined a monastery until Lore of the Traditions is out. Our show is made possible by our executive producers, who include Christopher Phillips, Oracle of Us hopefully getting a big chunky Disparates book, Buck Farmer, Oracle of Cut Segments, where James Sobrano says if there are any errors that you should just blame Matt Dawkins, and Oracle, John Widener, Oracle of well-fitting pants that just aren't in style anymore. Additionally, thanks to Alex, Anders S., Anon, Birdo, Boo, Boogers, 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 Brad of the Blue, Bryce Perry, Chris B., Dan Svensson, Dennis Osborne, Elliot Osborne, Gargan Lenoir, George Lara, Guy Conan Stewart, Ia Bull, Isabel Castillo, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Biggs, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Josh H., Joshua Heath, Carl Halperin, Leslie Weatherstone, Matt Prohl, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Ralph Scheinhammer, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Rob H., Ryan Hilton, Ryan Kendi, Sam Tobin, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, William Connolly, William Martin, and W. Starter. Our EP shout-out is to Patrick Mulder, who reminds me of Fox Mulder from the X-Files series, notably played by Marcus Turner, who played Fox Mulder in high school, who was also in Air Bud. Many forget that Air Bud didn't just have one sequel, Air Bud Golden Receiver, but an additional 12 more, which included Air Bud World Pup, Air Bud Seventh Inning Fetch, Air Bud Spikes Back, Air Buddies, Snow Buddies, Space Buddies, Santa Buddies, Spooky Buddies, Treasure Buddies, and Super Buddies, the Buddies film featuring the brood of Air Bud. Additionally, one of the spinoffs had a spinoff, the Santa Paws series, The Search for Santa Paws and Santa Paws 2, The Santa Pups. When I think of there never being a rule in Maids that says a dog can't play basketball, I'll think of you. If you super liked this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at maidsthepodcast@gmail.com or at maidsthepodcast on Twitter. We have a hopping Discord community at discord.me/maidsthepodcast. If you like us, give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to maidsthepodcast.com for show notes and all of the previous shows. Now go change reality, but mostly please back the Kickstarter, but change reality, but also the Kickstarter. Bye.